This episode is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street. Do you need a conference room for your next meeting? Learn more by visiting 100bogart.com.
Hi, this is Ethan Frisch.
And I'm Jenny Dorsey.
And we are the co-hosts of Why Food here on Heritage Radio Network.
We've both been huge fans of Heritage Radio since, I don't know, forever. And we are super excited to announce that Heritage Radio is celebrating its 10-year anniversary this year.
Think of 10 years of amazing shows, amazing guests, amazing interviews. You have access to all of those things for free, which is pretty incredible. But we are a nonprofit, and we do depend on your support and ultimately your donations to be able to keep doing this.
So we are doing a big donation drive right now, and we would love to see your support. We also have some really great prizes, including
spices from my spice company, Burlap and Barrel. I will curate a set of 6 spices for anyone who feels generous enough to donate in the $500 category.
So go today to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to help support the overall radio network, or you can support us specifically if you click on Why Food in the designation drop-down menu. Thank you so much for listening to Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening. Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about innovators, entrepreneurs, career changers, and all the interesting people who are doing interesting things in food. I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch, and Jenny is not with us this week. She's prepping for a big dinner this weekend. So I'm on my own, but I have 2 awesome guests, people I've gotten to know over the last year and a half or something, right? Almost 2 years?
Yeah.
Eunice Byun and David Wen, who are the co-founders of Material, a kitchenware brand. I'm going to let you describe it because I'm going to butcher it. Please go ahead. Tell us what you do.
Sure, absolutely. So yeah, Dave and I are the co-founders of Material, and we are a direct-to-consumer kitchenware company. And we're really inspired by the notion that most consumers don't really know what they truly need or want in their kitchen, because we live in a society that has a ton of stuff. And I'm sure all of you guys listening can relate that we have junk drawers full of things in our kitchens. And Dave and I really wanted to figure out, how do you bring more intention and design back into the kitchen and really ensure that for those people who love to cook, how do you inspire them with the tools that they reach for on a daily basis? And the best way that we thought we could do that is create less, you know, create more intention behind each and every single thing that we create and build and design, such that that is your go-to knife, that is your go-to pair of tongs. So we launched about a little over a year ago, in March of 2018, and it's been incredible just to hear what people's response has been to just having more high-quality, beautifully designed things in their kitchen.
Neither of you came from kitchenware, industrial design, even professional kitchens. This was all new for you. How did you get into this? How did you decide that this was what you needed to be doing?
Yeah, I can speak for myself, and I know Dave can share a little bit of his story too, but you know, I actually grew up in a kitchen, in that my dad owned a restaurant in San Diego. So as much as I've never been in the industrial design world or even in the culinary world, so to speak, I spent every afternoon and weekend in my dad's kitchen and just with fascination, like watching what was happening, loving just the energy and the spirit of the place, and really seeing just how food brought people together. And my dad was doing a lot of the cooking himself, and he's not a classically trained chef or anything by any means. So I think there was always something in me that connected with food and just being in the place where people loved and cherished food. And then, you know, you start to get older and you realize that you're supposed to have a quote unquote profession. And for me, you know, my very first job out of college was in finance. I was at Goldman Sachs as an analyst, and quickly realized that there was a big disconnect between what I truly love in life and the passions that I have and the day-to-day work that I was doing. And it took me a while to, I think, ultimately end up in this space, in the food world, in this kind of home cooking, I think, industry. But I think it's really been there all along, and it's been planted by seeing just the power of food and how people can just come together over it. So yeah, as much as I've navigated through the worlds of finance and retail and beauty, I think my heart has always been in the kitchen, which is, it's a nice homecoming.
What kind of restaurant did your father have?
He had a Chinese food restaurant in San Diego, and he's had restaurants. Let's see, I was actually born in Kansas, so he was one of the first, I think, Asian restaurants in El Dorado, Kansas. So.
How did that happen? How did he wind up opening a restaurant in Kansas?
I don't know. I ask him this all the time. So when he immigrated from South Korea, my grandfather happened to be in Kansas, of all places.
Sure.
And my actually grandfather was he is the true like consummate entrepreneur. He was just someone who hustled day in and day out. Was one of the first people to kind of import stuff into Korea from China. And he's always been someone who's on the move, thinking of new business opportunities. So I truly think for him, he was in the middle of Kansas and was like, hey, there's no Asian food. I think there's a market opportunity. And he just created it. So when my dad had come, he was an engineer by schooling. He was planning on going back to school. And my grandfather said, hey, we need a little bit of help just before you go back to school. Like, we just need you to pitch in a little bit, help us out at the restaurant. And it ended up just kind of consuming my father. And my dad helped him build it. And then ultimately, you know, when we moved to San Diego, he started building his own restaurants.
Did he put you to work in the kitchen as a kid?
I don't think he wanted to, but I was very eager to. So I was that kid who like would pull the little, this is probably dating me now, but like, you know, when you have the little, order that you would take the little notes on, and it would make that like nice copy for it, and you'd rip it off, and then like you'd stick it
on,
the carbon copy, you'd stick it under a bell,
pad,
and you'd like ring the bell type of thing. I loved doing that.
Ringing
so
the bell.
I loved doing the whole thing. So like my mom would be like, okay, Eunice, you need to go do homework. And I'm like, no, let me just take this order. And people I think were like, oh, here's this cute little girl who's like asking for our order. And I loved it. Like I loved watching everything happening in the front of the house and in the back of the house. So I was like that kid who was running back and forth constantly. And my parents were like, just study, just do your work.
That's awesome. And Dave, how about you? How did you, what was your entry point into the world of food and kitchenware?
My background is similar to Eunice's, where that my home life was always around the kitchen. You know, I remember my mom, cooking Vietnamese food on Sundays and the whole house smelling of like amazing smells and spices. And that's always kind of been the cornerstone of my family life. But professionally, my route to material was a little bit circuitous. So after during grad school in Boston, where I studied law and business, I knew pretty early on that I would probably be the world's worst lawyer. And it just wasn't for me. So I kind of had to think about what I wanted to do. And I wanted to sort of be at the intersection of commerce and creativity. So I thought fashion would be a good training ground for that. So I was fortunate enough to meet the CEO of Valentino New York. So I worked there for about 4.5 years doing supply chain, business operations, merchandising strategy. And then, I was there for a while, learned a lot, and then moved on to Chanel, which was a bigger, but quite similar in terms of the role I was doing. And then, Eunice and I were talking about what we wanted to do, our next step, and we both sort of had this dissatisfaction of our kitchen and the self-food in our kitchen. And that's when we launched Material.
So tell me about that conversation. How did you two meet and how did you get to that conversation? I mean, there are lots of people who talk about, I don't like any of my knives or my tongs aren't any good, but very, very few of them start a company to make those things. So how was that? How did that happen?
I mean, you can definitely tell it better than me because she just has a much better memory than me, but it started off very slowly, a lot of, meetings at her apartment or coffee shops or Russ and Daughters. But I'll let her give the full story.
Yeah. I think a lot of these things happen pretty organically, right? So you start with, hey, I have an idea. And I think it starts translating from an idea into, oh my God. And I thought about it all last night and did some research and realized that there's no company out there that's really approaching the kitchen in such a modern way and really thinking about this new era of home cooks and the needs, how much they've evolved. And then that starts to get into, okay, so then what would we change? What would we do differently? And it almost snowballs. So I wouldn't say it was like there was a pact that we made like one day, one night that this was going to be what we were going to do. I think it became the culmination of that, like that itch that you keep scratching almost. And then it kind of just keeps building and building and building and building. building. And I think for us, it was really kind of, yes, the idea, but also just starting to see things happening around us. Like Dave mentioned, you know, yes, we'd meet at my apartment. The reason we'd meet at my apartment was because I had like a 6-month-old daughter at that time. And so I went from going out and loving, you know, eating at all these nice places with my husband and whatnot, to all of a sudden being like, I have a baby. We don't go out as much as we used to. So let's try and recreate all these dishes at home that we used to love. And we just got more and more and more into home cooking. And it wasn't just unique to me. As I started to talk to more and more friends, I realized that that was a really common trend of like something that happened. We always say like maybe mid-20s, late-20s, where people are just like, hey, like I'm kind of tired of going out and doing that whole thing. You know, why don't you just come over and why don't we cook something or bring something, or, you know, we can pick up some stuff and cook some other stuff. So it was really like observing some of the patterns around us and recognizing that, you know, a lot of these big traditional kitchenware companies were almost missing the mark. They were just like using old marketing data that was like, hey, this is who the, you know, perfect customer of kitchenware is. And we were seeing that starting to evolve and change. So I think it was a little bit of just, okay, the idea coupled with the observations coupled with, ooh, now we actually have product ideas, right? I don't think it actually started with the product concept first and foremost.
What was your first product? What was your entry point into this world?
We were very ambitious in that we launched with 7 products.
Sure, why not?
Exactly.
I remember Dave and I would have conversations where like, well, we could definitely start with a knife, but if you start with one knife, you really need a big knife and a small knife. And then based on that, we're like, well, that's not sufficient enough. You really need to think about it in terms of, hey, if I were to build my very first like adult kitchenware collection, what would that look like? And that meant we had 7 items, which to anyone building a business out there, it is definitely a challenge when you're trying to perfect 7 items, because you're only as good as kind of the laggard of the group, right? Whether it's from a delivery perspective or just manufacturing or whatever those timelines look like, that last one is always going to be the one that holds you up. But we're really proud of, I think, what we accomplished, because we did it, I'd say, in pretty record time of just getting those 7 items pulled together and then really feeling as though we had done enough of the R&D on our side as well as the testing once we started to receive some products that it was a great first collection to go out to market with.
How did you sort of conceive the products in the first place? You sat down together at Eunice's apartment with a blank sheet of paper and said, we need a better pair of tongs. What was the process to go from that conversation to a design, to talking to potential manufacturers, to actually bringing it in and delivering it to your customers?
Yeah, so I think where we started off was just knowing what we wanted the tool to do. You know, obviously tongs have to grip well, have to open smoothly, etc. Coming up with like those kind of key features, working with our designer to create a cool design that incorporated those features, and then just a lot of testing, a lot of research to see if we were that product filled that need, and then just working with the factory to make sure that they could execute as closely to our vision as possible.
I think what stands out to me with your line is that it's not just the sort of basics, right? Tongs need to grip well and open smoothly, and that's fine, your tongs do that, but they also have, and all of your products have, these really thoughtful, intentional design touches beyond the necessities. So how do you, Dave, you talked earlier about the intersection of creativity and what was the other word you used?
And commerce,
right. Yeah. So how did you know how to be creative in that way, considering you hadn't really come from those, from a design background or a...
Well, I think that was part of, when we first set out, that was part of our core values was having thoughtful design, and that meant us just spending as much time on it as it required to have those thoughtful elements.
Yeah.
I think part of it is, you know, we benefited from not coming from the industry, from not having a preconceived notion of, well, the best-selling pair of tongs has this design, therefore our design has to be exactly the same. And I think, you know, also not being someone who's been in a professional kitchen. Like, I think we were very uninhibited in terms of our perspective when it came to each tool, because we were just going based off of almost the collection of items that we had gotten ourselves over the years. And I mean, I don't know about you, Ethan, but like I look back at some of the things I had in my first kitchenware collection and Lord knows where they came from. I think like my mom gave me a couple of things, some roommates had left something behind, and you just like amass some of these items. And so from our perspective, it was like, okay, we can take all that. We can actually look at it and say, wouldn't it just be better if like we had a spoon where the head of it held exactly like a certain amount of liquid, so I don't have to pull a measuring cup down? Because I think what we were trying to reduce as home cooks was the dirty dish factor. Like, I want to reduce the amount of dishes I have to clean up at the end of the night. So it was almost coming at it from like a very outsider's perspective of just like day-to-day life. And quite honestly, we'd come in every morning and be like, okay, well, when I was cooking last night, like it really bothered me how when I put my tongs down and I don't have a spoon rest for my tongs, like it would just dirty up my countertop. And so it was like those small observations. I think you just have to become a student of like your day to day and really be able to tap into like, what are those mild annoyances that as a lay consumer, you may not be able to pinpoint, but when you like change your perspective, like it almost like jumps out at you. I was like, oh my God, like, yeah, that is something that I would want to change. And then what Dave and I forced ourselves to do is then prioritize, because you don't want to end up with like the Ferrari of tongs, but then all of a sudden it has so many contraptions and whatnot that no one knows how to actually use it. So we really had to go through the process of saying, okay, what are like those two key things that we want to make sure we nail and land in these products? And then everything else, you kind of work with the design and you figure out, okay, what's going to make that design work, or is it going to make it too cumbersome that we have to start all over again?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I can really relate my experience in professional kitchens where the culture, first of all, there are professional dishwashers, so you never worry about using too many dishes.
Right.
In fact, you're sort of encouraged to just like use whatever you need to make the dish perfect. And also, I think there's this culture of making it work regardless of the circumstances, especially in New York City where kitchens are really small and storage space is really limited. So your tongs become an extension of your hand. You never put them down, so you don't need to think about where they rest on the counter. Like, you literally never put them down. I think you're absolutely right that coming from a different perspective gave you a different perspective. What were some of the lessons that you feel like you brought with you from previous careers that have either made this easier or made this more challenging?
I think one of the things that Dave and I talk quite a lot about is, you know, he comes from the world of luxury fashion. Most recently, I come from the world of beauty. And those are two industries where, like, you've got passion, right? Like, if you find that red lipstick that is your shade, that is your red lipstick, right? It kind of defines who you are. Or similarly, like, if you, the very first maybe Chanel item that you own, like maybe that's a very like something that you've been saving up for or whatnot. But they come, we both come from these industries where it's like there's so much I think personal attachment to what it is that, you know, is being created in that space. So I think we benefited from that because we said, how do we create that connectivity between the individual and the item in this world where everything is seen as so functional, right? So how do we bring a little bit of that emotion or that sense of it's mine, right, into this world that is the kitchen? And so I think we really drew upon our previous industries and seeing just how diehard people can become about these things and tried to translate that into a way that made sense within the world of the kitchen. Now, that comes definitely with its own drawbacks because, in some regards, I feel like we probably obsess over things more than most people would because we've been, I think, trained and taught to be like super, super, super meticulous on some of the product design elements, just coming again from the worlds that we came from. But that's our cross to bear as, you know, I think as founders of the company is just really ensuring that, you know, everything that we create does have that intention behind it and will always honor the end customer and what we think he or she wants and needs.
Could you talk a little bit about your co-founder relationship, how you sort of conceived that from the beginning, how you decide who does what, how you play to each of your strengths as you build the business?
Yeah, I think it was actually, fortunately for us, pretty, pretty natural and pretty organic. Eunice, I like to say that we're the yin to each other's yang. So yeah, I think we kind of thought of it sort of like as a restaurant in a way, in the structure of the company, whereas Unix would sort of handle the front of house, so to speak, and I would sort of handle the back of house. And, you know, it's been it's pretty smooth so far.
Yeah. And we've known each other a long time, too. I think that's one of the things that has helped our relationship from day one is we go like 13 years back. Yeah. And we've always had a friendship first and foremost. Dave was at my wedding. I know his family. He knows my family. And I think it just helps because there's a sense of trust and shared values from day one. Like, I know what he stands for. I know that he's such an honest, good, hardworking guy. And that's, I mean, what other qualities would you want in a co-founder, right? Other than someone who you know that inevitably, like, you can go into battle with and, like, you've got each other's backs. And I think that's a really an important thing for us because we do operate in such different parts of the business. So it does come down to, like, how much can you trust that other person is, like, getting what they need to get done and leading the company in the right way, because he does handle much more of the supply chain and operations, and I am doing a lot more of the branding and marketing stuff. But I think it helps that not only have our skill sets been different, but personality-wise we're different. And I think it all serves as just a really good complement to kind of one another and what we each bring to the table.
It seems like the idea and the process of developing it together took a less common route. I think often one person will have an idea and will look for a co-founder to work on it with them. Do you have any advice for somebody who's in that position, who's trying to find the right partner to work with to build an idea into a reality, who may not have more than a decade of friendship to build on?
Yeah. You know, I do think having a co-founder, more than anything, it's like good for your sanity and like mental health.
Yeah, for sure.
Just having someone who knows the ins and outs of like those daily stressors that sometimes you can't articulate to someone else. You know, I think finding someone who does have a complementary, not only skill set, but again, I think personality really matters. Like if you've got someone, I tend to be much more vocal. Like I'm pretty dramatic about things. Like I'm hot and I'm cold. Like I feel kind of immediately, whereas Dave is so good about being like balanced about things. And so it even goes beyond, I think, skill set. I think it comes down to like, how do you make decisions, right? And how can you ensure that the other person is going to almost kind of help you see the blind spots that you might have as an individual. And I think that's where that balance is important. Now, I also know people who don't have co-founders and they're doing extremely well. I think it just comes down to having a community of people that you can reach out to and rely on and have some support, because we all know this. I mean, it is hard to build a business and you really do put so much of yourself into it. And I think being connected with other people who like know what it's like to have those sleepless nights and to have those moments of like, oh my God, like what is going on? I think it's so important whether or not that person actually has the official title of being, you know, co-founder or not.
Yeah. Tell me about your community. Who were your supporters in the early days? Who did you go to for that kind of cheerleading that you needed?
Oh God. From a business perspective, I mean, we were really fortunate to have gotten connected with some investors early on who we absolutely love. I mean, yes, they are investors, but we see them so much more as advisors, just confidants, people who, you know, we can inherently really trust and who are looking out for our best interest. And that's helped a lot. I know for myself personally, like my husband, he is the best product tester of them all, because he will be like, guys, this is not cutting it, or whatever it is, you know? And I'd say beyond that, it's been, you know, again, for myself as a female founder, I've been so fortunate to meet some amazing women who are building their own companies, and have gone through the highs and lows of fundraising, have gone through, you know, all of the press stuff that you have to do, et cetera. And, you know, there are other moms that I've met, which has been equally amazing to find people who just know not only the stresses that you have in the workplace, but also at home. So I'd say, I mean, we're fortunate being in New York. New York has an amazingly supportive startup community. And I think we've been very fortunate to get connected with some of those folks early on and I think really develop trusted relationships where we're swapping, you know, who are you working on with, who are you working with for digital marketing or how much are you paying, you know, your agency for this and, you know, really getting into the nitty gritty because sometimes you don't know what you don't know. So just having a friend who you can ask, I think is really helpful. So we've lucked out from that more than anything.
Let's take a quick break and we'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by 100 Bogart, a new building in Bushwick, Brooklyn that provides offices, co-working, event spaces, and a brand new podcast recording room. Have you been dreaming of starting your very own podcast in Brooklyn? You can now rent space in 100 Bogart's custom-built podcast room to record interviews, voiceover, and commentary. The room is fitted out with two microphones, mixing board, and a MacBook Pro running Pro Tools. You can rent the space by the hour, and a rental of an hour or more includes a 100 Bogart co-working pass. That means complimentary coffee, tea, and access to your own desk for the rest of the day. So what are you waiting for? Get started on your next audio project. 100 Bogart has the space and amenities you need to kickstart your podcast. Learn more at 100bogart.com or call their team at 718-362-3539.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. Hi, my name is Sam Benrubi, and I'm the host of The Grape Nation on Heritage Radio Network. With this show, we bring wine to the people. Each week, we bring the best guests in wine on, taste different wines on air, and invite our listeners to taste with us. You'll find our approach to wine decidedly unsnobby. You can find The Grape Nation wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back. You're listening to Why Food. I'm Ethan Frisch, and I'm alone in the studio. No Jenny, unfortunately, this week. But I'm joined by Dave and Eunice, who are the co-founders of Material. In the first half of the show, we were talking a little bit about your professional histories and how you arrived at founding the company. Let's start by if you would walk us through the is it seven or eight products now? Nine products?
Oh, God.
Well, I guess start by walking us through the products that you make and what makes them different, why your tongs or why your spoon or why your knife are different from what's.
Yeah, maybe we can start off with our base, which is my personal favorite. Yeah. It holds basically three knives on a magnetic wall as well as utensils. That item came basically, as you said, from our ability to approach it with a fresh point of view. So, you know, for us, we've all received like 12 piece or 24 piece knife blocks, and we use like two or three of those knives. So we wanted to do something that was more efficient, that didn't, you know, eat up your counter space with, you know, this huge piece of wood with all these knives that you don't use. So, you know, again, like kind of coming with a fresh point of view of, you know, how do we create something that kind of gives easy access to our customers of these core items? So again, it was just a lot of, you know, working with our designer, just thinking through it, many, many iterations of having this this final item that we finally came up with that, you know, uses a magnet to hold knives right next to your core items.
So sort of a countertop.
Yeah. It's like sort of vessel.
Okay.
Made of wood.
And tell me about your knives. What makes them unique?
Yeah, our knives are these really perfectly balanced knives made from Japanese three layers of steel. They're sharpened to, I think, 13 degrees on each side, so you can really cut through things easily. They're clad in corrosion resistant metal, so you can kind of don't have to worry about if you leave in the sink for a little bit, and it's easy to clean. So yeah.
And I guess, I mean, while we're on the subject of the knives, Dave, you sort of focus on the operations and the manufacturing side of it. I think something that is a challenge for a lot of entrepreneurs is having a vision, coming up with it sort of internally yourself, and then having to translate that to a manufacturer. Often you're a very small customer of theirs. Yeah. They don't care that much about the little details that you think are really important. How did you have those conversations? How did you make sure that the details that were important to you were also being sort of attended to by your manufacturers?
Yeah, I think that's where coming from our respective backgrounds really helped, because it, I think, helped us know that how important it was to set really high standards. And that's not to waver in that, because you'll get pressure from the factories to say, you know, we can't do this. You should kind of let the standards slip a little bit. But I think we just really wanted to create products that people loved and were passionate about. And that kind of helped us, like, really, you know, stick to our guns and push the factories to their utmost capabilities. But of course, sometimes you just have to iterate, because what's designed on a piece of paper isn't really necessarily translatable to a mass production process. So there was definitely a lot of a combination of iterations and reworking, but also knowing or trying to remember what to prioritize and what to know was key.
I think the other thing that you sometimes forget is to invite your manufacturing partners into your business strategy with you. Like, actually help them understand the bigger picture, and not just, hey, this is what we need and we need to have it. But to actually say, hey, so we're actually a new company. We're trying to sell this stuff online. So that means that some of the things that we value are going to be different than what you're used to with your other clients, because those customers are selling through a retailer and all they're trying to do is sell it in. We need to make sure that we can compel people to purchase it off of an image, such that, you know, we want to make sure that our handles, the way that they appear, the texture of them, the color of them, it's going to be very different than what you're used to. Or, you know, in our knives, we have something which is called the Hammond line, and it's basically to indicate the different layers. And, you know, they'd say, hey, it's not going to be super consistent across all the knives, because it's a really natural process of the layers kind of being kind of shown. And we said, no, we love that. We have a story to tell there, right? So I think it's being able to actually invite some of these partners into, like, the story itself, like, help them understand how and the why, as opposed to just demanding it. And I think that's how you are able to operate as sometimes the smallest company on that their totem pole, because they actually can share in your vision with you. And quite honestly, you know, especially with the online world, a lot of these manufacturing partners recognize that they need to get more digitally savvy, and they need to change the distribution of maybe customers that they're servicing that are, you know, in more of a traditional model versus a more, I'd say, progressive model. So I think the more sometimes you're able to educate them, it does come back and help you in the long run.
And tell me about some of the other tools in your set.
Yeah, so as Dave mentioned, we have the base. We have now three knives. You know, we always think about it through the lens of what are the must-haves. So a chef's knife, a paring knife, and a serrated knife are kind of the three most commonly used knives. Then we have a couple of core tools. So we've talked about the tongs. We have a metal spoon, which holds exactly a quarter cup of liquid. So really easy, four scoops, one cup, pretty seamless there. We have a slotted spatula that has a little bit of give in it, so that it's kind of a cross between a standard fish spatula and maybe just a regular spatula, so it has some more versatility. And then we have a wood spoon. So that's perfect for, you know, different cooking surfaces. It's something that we love just because it ages so nicely over time. And since then, you know, since our launch, we've expanded into things like a whisk, where we redesigned it because we thought, hey, cleaning a balloon whisk sometimes is like the worst thing because everything gets stuck. So we just redesigned the shape of the loop so that it was easier to clean, and ultimately solved issues that we had, which was like you put your whisk down and it rolls all around. So we designed it so it actually can stand tall up into a pot, or, you know, even on the surface itself or in a bowl. We have a slotted spoon now, which is kind of our take on the Asian cooking tool, the spider, because we love the functionality of the spider, but sometimes I think it scares people to kind of think what would I do with that in my kitchen. So we kind of married the slotted spoon with the spider in order to create something that we thought was very versatile. And then since then, you know, we've come out with a wood cutting board called the angled board, and then the stand, which is kind of the equivalent of the base for just the knives, because we got so much customer feedback of, oh my God, I love this, but I have knives of my own, but I like this base. And so we came up with a really cool magnetic knife stand that can hold up to 8 knives. And it's just for someone, who wants things kind of on their countertop, but in a really compact fashion.
What's next? What's on your list?
Oh, God. We are never sleeping when it comes to product design. So we're about to launch another type of cutting board, which we're really excited about. We can definitely share more about that once it goes live. We are also coming out with our cookware collection, so that's coming out this year as well.
Pots and pans.
We're coming out with pans and pots, and super excited to kind of continue to outfit, you know, the kitchen with again that same intention of what it is that we're bringing. So we're not having 8 gazillion different pans and pots and configurations and things like that, but it's really purposeful in terms of the sizes and just the shapes and ultimately what we're bringing to market. And then we have a few more kind of surprises around holiday. So we're pretty busy when it comes to what we're introducing. But again, I think it always goes back to how do we make sure that what we do is super purposeful and that nothing is truly meant to cannibalize one another within our collection, because we don't want people to feel as though, you know, they need to go and buy, you know, multiple things, you know, 5 different spatulas from us.
And I know you're sort of approaching this in ways that are differently from established companies in a lot of ways, both because you're selling exclusively online and also because you're very thoughtful in the way that you approach sort of conscious consumerism and not wanting to add to the clutter in the kitchen. Can you talk me through kind of those two approaches, both what it means to sell a physical product on the internet where people have to make a purchase decision without actually being able to touch it, and then also how you kind of approach not adding to that pile of,
For sure,
old tools in your kitchen drawer.
For sure. I mean, there's a lot of tension on that. But, you know, on the first part, I think it just comes down to making sure that every branded touch point is emoting that sense of kind of high quality, you know, well-designed, just really thoughtful approach. And it's everything from, you know, whether it's the posts that we do on social media to the email you'll get back if you send a note to our customer service to really anything that we do, the packaging. You know, we really try and make sure that everything shows that we are high quality, like we are creating something of value. And I think that's helped a lot because, you know, we're very fortunate. We've been in business for over a year and we've only had probably less than 2% of our orders returned, which in the world of e-commerce is virtually like you're close to zero, right? And that's pretty wild considering how personal, you know, the knife selection process can be for someone. Maybe they want to see what the weight is or use it over time, but we've been really fortunate, I think, to utilize the digital medium as a way to connect and convey that information very, very openly, and, you know, be able to tell that story, I think, in a way that helps people understand, hey, like, this is good stuff and I'm getting it at a great value. In terms of how we approach kind of conscious consumption, you know, it's something that is a real core value of ours. Like, we're always thinking about how do we do, in some regards, more with less stuff? And that's something we're always challenging ourselves in the product design process. But, you know, it's tricky. Like, we look at the industry now and we're like, gosh, like, how many plastic utensils are out there, right? And how many times have you needed to go replace a spatula because you left it in the pan a little bit too long and that thing just melted on you, right? You know, is that a function of the product quality potentially, but is it also a really nice way for that company to build in natural replenishment? 1000%, right? Because if they know that you're going to need to replace the spatula every, you know, let's call it 2 years, then great. You know, they know that you're going to come back for it. And when Dave and I started Material, we actually said, how do we break that cycle? How do we make it so that you don't have to replace it, but that you can actually have high quality stuff that'll last you from maybe your very first apartment after college all the way up through maybe having gotten married or, you know, your first child or whatever. How do we stay with you for a longer period of time and really create these pieces that could be heirloom pieces that you pass on? Now, yes, that scares sometimes, I think, business people because they're like, well, then there's no replenishment. And our answer to that is, yeah, but there's always a connection to the brand. Like, you are going to believe that Material provides you really high quality things for your kitchen. And guess what? There's a lot in the kitchen, right? There's a lot that can be innovated upon. There's a lot that can be whittled down and I think perfected in a way that helps customers. Like, it helps the everyday home cook when you're like, hey, this is like the one cutting board you'd probably benefit from having, right? You don't have to walk into a Williams-Sonoma and be overwhelmed by the sea of sameness. You can actually say, okay, cool, that's the one that I'm gonna get, and it's gonna wear with me really nicely. So it's a constant push and pull. I mean, there are times when we're like, man, if we could go back, we'd slightly tweak that one item a little bit. But you know, we try and approach all of our stuff with a high level of conviction of like, hey, we did that. Like, are we just trying to better it on the margins, right? And that's when you start to talk yourself off the ledge and you're like, all right, cool. Like, we still stand by what we did, you know, and maybe there's a future generation of it years from now that like we might make some slight tweaks on. But we have a lot more, I think, road and path ahead of us when it comes to, you know, reimagining things within one's kitchen.
How do your customers find you?
Yeah.
It's always anytime I ask an entrepreneur, I mean, myself included, yeah, this question, there's always this like sigh, like the internet people, yes, are just there and I we know. Don't ever really know how we I engage know. With them. But what do you think? What has worked for you?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of it, we've been fortunate to have received, I think, some really great press early on. And, you know, that's helped a lot just get not only the awareness, but like the authenticity of like, hey, that stamp of approval of we made it onto GQ's best stuff of the year. Like, we're a kitchenware company and we're next to like Nike. And it's pretty cool when you can actually say, hey, they like the design and the concept of what we're doing such that they, you know, honored us with this accolade. So I think a lot of the kind of early press has helped. Word of mouth, you know, I think people undervalue in some regards just being really good at customer service and making sure that, you know, every email gets answered within like the first hour, that we're always helpful, that we're always making sure that everyone has an amazing experience such that I can't even tell you the number of times we've gotten emails from customers that are like, I'm going to tell all my friends about you guys because you guys have been so incredible. And then, you know, we do a lot of digital marketing. You know, we definitely, I think my background coming from the world of digital has helped us navigate through that really kind of black hole because it is a little bit, you can blow a lot of money in that space. And then, you know, just we've been very lucky to have also good success with like influencers, which I feel like is now like a 4-letter word in the marketing world because so many people are like, oh my God, we put all this money into it and it didn't work. And I think our philosophy has just been create good stuff and, you know, send it out to them. And if they like it, they'll do something with it. And if they don't, they don't. So we don't put too much pressure on ourselves in terms of what the expectation is. But we've been lucky to have people just like the stuff and post about it and keep posting about it. And we've been able to develop some really nice relationships based on that.
Do you have any quick words of advice on a press strategy? That's something that a lot of entrepreneurs struggle with and can really, especially in the early days, make or break a business.
Yeah, I'd say always, always, always be really mindful of what your clear story and angle is and vary it per outlet. Like, don't just go out and say, here's one blanket pitch and send that to everyone. But, you know, do your research, know what, who you're reaching out to, what their beat is. Like, what do they typically write about? Are they someone who wants to take more of a personal approach to something, in which case maybe highlight more of your personal founding story? Are they someone who likes to always talk about, you know, the latest and greatest, in which case give them a ton of data that says, here's what proves that this is like the best thing since sliced bread. So I think it's like, be really mindful about who you're reaching out to, because these people are getting thousands upon thousands of emails on any given basis. And, you know, the more that you can have a warm introduction, the better. Like, go through your LinkedIn, figure out, does anyone know them in any way, shape, or form? Can someone make an introduction? Because that's going to help you cut through the riffraff pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's great. In the last few minutes of the podcast, we're going to do our usual fun rapid fire segment. I guess we can bounce between you. You can both answer each question.
I'm nervous.
Or if anybody wants to pass, you're lucky you've got a co-founder to pass it off to.
The
advantages, right, of having a co-founder. Usually we only have one guest and they have to take it. They have to answer all the questions themselves. I'll just sort of put them out there and however you want to answer them. If you could master any skill overnight, what skill would it be?
For me, I wish I was much better at cooking Vietnamese food. It's definitely a weakness of mine, and my mom lets me know it.
What dishes would you make if you woke up tomorrow morning being an exceptional Vietnamese chef? What would you make?
There's this like spicy soup called Bún Bò Huế, which you might have had before.
Oh yeah.
For the life of me, I've tried multiple times to do it, but to no success.
Does your mother or do your parents have certain specialties that they're really proud of?
That's the one. Yeah.
And your mother hasn't taught you?
She's holding the recipe hostage.
Okay. What about you, Eunice?
Does it have to be like an actual skill, or can it be like mind reading?
Sure. A superpower? Go for it.
A superpower. I think it's the biggest thing when you're an entrepreneur is you just want to see the future. Like, you really do, because you're already looking into the future, building towards the future. So I feel like if it was, what was that that show growing up, like the Daily Edition or the Late Edition? I don't know, where the guy would get up the newspaper every morning for the following day. Like, that's what I would want. I'd like to know what's happening, like, a few, I don't know, even 48 hours ahead of time, because I feel like a lot of the curveballs you get thrown in the startup world is just something you're like, God, I wish I could have anticipated that. Like, maybe I could have seen it. So that would probably be the skill I'd like to master.
There's a great cartoon that ran in the New Yorker. You know, like those one panel cartoons. I found so inspiring. I had it as my cell phone background for a year or something. It's like a line drawing, black and white, a guy standing in a window and a woman sitting at a chair, sort of in a living room setting. And the guy's looking out the window, sort of gazing out the window, and the woman's looking at him. And the caption is, "I think whatever's going to happen next has already happened." This idea that, like, we think we can affect anything, but nope, like, something is going to happen and we just have to be ready to roll with it.
Totally.
What is the best meal that you've ever eaten that costs, say, under $10?
My mom's cooking.
Okay. That was easy.
Yeah, she's an incredible cook. And what I love the most about my mom's cooking is, as a Korean immigrant, you would think that all she made growing up was Korean food, but she loved experimenting. So, like, she was that mom who on St. Patrick's Day would, like, make corned beef and, like, steam cabbage and have like a really spicy mustard and feed that to us. And, you know, it was always kind of experimenting. I remember when boba was like a huge thing, she's like, I'm going to make this, I'm going to try it. And she just was always experimenting with different types of cuisines, and her cooking is phenomenal. So even though she may not have ever been to that country, she inevitably would have nailed the flavor profiles. So definitely mom's cooking.
Did your mom do most of the cooking at home?
She did. I think my dad, when he got home, was like,
I don't want to cook anymore.
I'm going near that. So yeah, a lot of the cooking was done by my mom.
Have you picked up skills or dishes from her?
Yeah, you know, it's like everyone says this when you're trying to learn from like your mom or your grandma or someone, like there's never a recipe. It's always just by feel or just because you've done it for so long. So my mom has tried to write things down, but now more than anything, it's just been whenever she's in New York, just cooking with her. And she makes amazing mandu, which is like a Korean dumpling. And so, you know, we've been able to learn that. A lot of the stews that are really good in Korean cooking. Yukgaejang, which is like this really spicy beef soup. She's taught me how to make, but the last thing I'm waiting for is that kimchi recipe. Like I need that in my life because there aren't enough good kimchi places. And so, yeah, that's the one that I'm holding out for and just really excited for.
What does your daughter like to eat?
Oh, she's a good eater. Like, I mean, knock on wood, she's four. She really likes everything. I think her favorite breakfast meal is an over easy egg with like freshly grated Parmesan and truffle oil in it. Like she really goes there. But no, she, I know,
I know.
She loves it. No, she's a good eater, but we just more than anything are always like, you don't have to like it, but you do have to try it. And I think that's helped a lot just because even this morning she's like, I took three bites of it and I did not like it. I'm like, cool. That's fine.
What was it?
It was a hard-boiled egg. It was so random. And she used to love them, but I don't know. I think I slightly overcooked it. But yeah, she's like, I don't like that. And I was like, okay, well, we'll just stick with your truffle eggs.
Cool. Dave, what about you? Best meal you've had for under 10 bucks?
Fried soft-shell crabs in Vietnam. Mm. I think it was at a specific place. And I think I went back three times in a row with my dad. Just because it was so good.
How did they prepare them?
I think it was just a freshness. It was in season. Like I can close my eyes and just know exactly how it looks like, how it tastes like. It was so evocative. But it was by far the best thing I've had in 10 bucks.
What was the sauce? I'm very curious.
I think it was Nuoc Mam, like the Vietnamese fish sauce.
Mm. How do you feel like those experiences are connected to the experience of eating at this place with your father versus the food itself? And I guess, I mean, since this is an interview about your business, how does that translate into the experience that you're trying to convey to your customers?
I think, at least for me personally, I think food is an instrument of bringing people together. So, you know, like having the soft shell crab was, you know, obviously great food, was also an opportunity to spend a little bit of time with my dad. And I think with material, a lot of the pleasure of having the company or working on the company is knowing that people are spending time together, like cooking for friends or family, and just spending quality time together.
What were your childhood lunches like? What did your parents give you to take to school?
My mom will probably be a little bit embarrassed that I'm sharing this, but I had very Americanized lunches. So I had Lunchables, school lunches, nothing fancy. I would trade like the little cheese packets with other kids for my Lunchables.
An entrepreneur, even at an early age, haggling over.
Trying to arbitrage the Lunchables, you know?
Yeah, your legal training.
Yeah.
Was that, I don't know, how did you have a certain nostalgia around that food? How do you feel about it now?
I think at that time, food was just fuel for the day. But I have more nostalgia for the stuff my mom made because it meant something. You actually like see her, you know, cutting the onions, cutting the beef, and there something that went into it. Whereas, you know, something like what I had for lunch was like a little bit more here you go to get you through the day. So there wasn't really any feeling behind it.
Yeah, Eunice, how about you?
I also, believe it or not, I feel like had very Americanized lunches, Lunchables for sure, sandwiches, probably because I feel like my mom at some point sent me with kimbap and I was like, Mom, that stinks. Like everyone noticed. And I think she probably just felt bad for me and took some pity on me and started sending me with stuff that I really wouldn't eat. And I remember actually very vividly sitting during the lunch time and actually like maybe grazing on it and just be like, ugh, this is disgusting, and like throwing it away. And then the second I would get home, I remember I would then just devour all the Korean food that my mom had at home, or especially as I got a little older, I started making my own stuff when I would come home because again, like I love food and I've always loved it, but you know, lunch time could be rough when you were coming from an immigrant family, for sure.
What are some of the more unexpected uses for your kitchen tools that your customers have told you about? Are there any, have they used them for anything crazy? They both have totally baffled looks on their faces.
Maybe this is a stupid question. No. I mean, I'm trying to think. Like, I'm not sure if, like, uses. I mean, we've definitely had people who, again, we'll just be like, is your knife good enough that I can, you know, butcher an entire animal with
cut
it?
Down a tree.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah. Oh, sure. But I don't think we've had too many crazy things. If anything, I think what's amazed us more is just when people have like multiple properties and you just all of a sudden start to see that they're like sending it to all these different places and you're like, must be nice to be you, but yet you have material in all your kitchens, so we're there for it. But
maybe you need a travel pack or something.
Something like that, exactly,
to their various estates.
But no, we haven't had too many too many wild sightings of material.
And last question, what's your kind of go-to easy get dinner on the table meal that you like to cook at home?
I would do like probably like a really simple pasta. Just because you, while the pasta is boiling, you can do other things. You can multitask really easily.
Yeah. I mean, we're definitely a pasta family, like a great like puttanesca or something where it's like packed with flavor and it really doesn't take that much stuff. And inevitably, you're always going to have a nice can of tuna somewhere, olives, capers, anchovies, like they're things that are in our pantry no matter what. So I'd say that's pretty much a go-to because it's pretty quick and easy to pull together.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for joining me this week.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Where can our listeners find you, read more about your company, find your products?
Yeah, for sure. So come visit us at materialkitchen.com. You can follow us on Instagram at materialkitchen. Drop us a DM, say hello. We're always responding, so we'd love to hear from you guys.
And you can, as always, reach us via our email, yfood@heritageradionetwork.org. You can contact me directly via my spice company. We're at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram, burlapandbarrel.com. Thanks to Jeet, our awesome engineer, for shepherding us through this week's episode. And thanks to Red Crickets for our theme song, which is Blind. We'll be back next week. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.